Hello, everyone. This is Tom Regan. I'm a licensed addiction counselor and certified grief counselor for Heartview Foundation in Bismarck. Welcome to a program we call Recovery Chronicles. This is a half-hour interview program that celebrates recovery from alcohol and drug addiction. And our guest today is Chadwick Kramer. And I've known Chadwick for a while, and he's a great person. And welcome. Thanks for coming.
Hello, Tom.
I'm glad you had the courage, if that's what it took, to say yes to being on the radio. And tell us a little bit about your growing up years, if you would, please.
Well, I'll introduce myself. My name is Chadwick Kramer. I'm an enrolled member of Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. My grandmother's name was Eva Seawalker. And I've grown up here in Bismarck most of my life. Growing up in Bismarck, I attended Catholic schools. I won't blame my addiction on them, but it was a really awesome experience being able to grow up here in Bismarck and grow up attending Catholic schools. Once I left Bismarck, I went to the University of Minnesota, and that's where the drinking started.
You were on your own, huh?
That's mm-hmm. where the drinking
yeah.
started.
Yeah.
Did you want to hear more about my childhood?
Well, let's jump right into it. And so was alcohol your drug of choice, or were there others?
My drugs of choice were, in the beginning, beer, of mm-hmm. course. After college and graduate school, I actually entered a period of sobriety of a number of years. And when I started taking pills, I had not started drinking again yet. The pills that were my drugs of choice were Ambien and benzodiazepines. Mm-hmm. And when I couldn't get a hold of those, it was pretty much vodka and cold pills.
Uh-huh.
So those were my drugs of choice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And how bad did it get, so to speak? I mean, what were some of the consequences of your usage?
Well, looking back now, I see a lot of consequences of my usage that I didn't see when I was in the middle of my active addiction. And I would say the biggest consequence was not having a relationship with my children.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely pulled back from me. I wasn't a safe person to be around anymore. And my sobriety date is 9/11/2015.
Congratulations.
I've been sober for a little over 2 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was the turning point? What happened? The day you decided you needed to do something about your so-called problem?
My daughter was 17 years old. She was planning to get married 3 days after her 18th birthday. And she came to me and said, "Dad, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't stop it. I'd like you to be part of it. However, I'm not sure that you're going to be sober on my wedding. And so I have a backup plan to walk me down the aisle, just in case you can't."
Mm.
And the date of her wedding was November 14th. I got sober on September 11th, which was a little over 2 months before her wedding. And the breaking point for me was just the idea that I was not going to be able to walk my daughter down the aisle at her own wedding. That was probably my breaking point, in addition to taking some benzodiazepines and drinking a lot of vodka and taking off from my house, and my wife actually called the cops on me. And she texted me and said, "I've called the cops. They're on their way to find you." So I said, "Well, then I'm going to leave the state." So I decided to drive to Minnesota to my buddy's farm about 6 hours from here. And she texted me that she had contacted Highway Patrol and they would be looking for me as well. They didn't catch me that day, but when I returned home, my wife kicked me out of the house, told me that I could live with my parents, that I was their problem now. And that in combination with the idea of not being able to walk my daughter down the aisle, I decided to get a second evaluation at HeartView and made the choice to go into the outpatient program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would you describe that as your bottom, or, you know, do you believe in bottoms?
That was definitely my bottom. Yeah. There were a lot of events leading up to it. Now, looking back, there were times when I would drink and take pills and get into the vehicle with my family in it. And I would drive. And there were times where I would remember the beginning of a trip. And then 3-4 hours later, I'd wake up and we'd be in Fargo or somewhere on a family trip. And my wife would say, okay, now are you okay to drive? And so she would pull me out from behind the wheel until I was sober enough to drive the family the rest of the way. There were a lot of events like that, that I would consider my bottom. They were all kind of a combination of events that culminated back in September of 2015.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you've ever been around other people in recovery, a word to the listeners, we usually say you have to hit bottom. I mean, you have to find your bottom. You have to hit your bottom before you finally decide to to do something about your problem. But I've heard people say they don't really believe in bottoms, that it's creating maybe a false notion, because as you know, a lot of people get into recovery because of the legal system, and maybe they haven't hit a so-called bottom, but they get better. I mean, they enter recovery and they stay there.
Yeah. You know, I would have been one of those statistics of being court ordered into treatment if I would have continued down the path that I was continuing down.
Yeah. So, what do you remember about being in treatment that was a changing point, or what were some of the changing points in treatment? Some of those early realizations about your behavior, about your addiction.
When I went into treatment, I went in with the notion that I would get clean for 30 days and I would come out of treatment not drinking. I had resigned myself to that fact that I was going to give up alcohol, but I wasn't ready to give up the pills. And so my counselor the first week of treatment said, I need you to bring in all your pills. And we're going to destroy them. Well, we'll help you taper, but then we're going to destroy them.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I told my counselor, I said, I'd like to have those pills for when I get out of treatment, because I, you know, my doctor prescribed them and I need them.
Yeah. After all, they're legal, right? They were prescribed.
Right. So I was holding on to the notion that I was going to be able to use my pills when I left treatment.
Yeah.
So that was one of the first realizations. Took me a few days, but I turned them in and never looked back.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. And I've known you for a while, Chadwick, and I hope you don't mind me getting into, you know, some sensitive territory, but you've recently experienced a pretty horrible loss, or horrible is not the right word, but a significant loss. If you could explain that, please, because I've got some questions to ask you about that.
Sure. I have two daughters, Hannah and Olivia. Is it okay to use their names on there?
Yeah, so if it's okay with them, you bet.
Okay, I'm sure. I won't use the last names, but Hannah recently passed away. She passed away on September 26th. A little over a month and a half ago. And we recently celebrated her 20th birthday, which was 11/11. So I've been trying to walk the road of recovery, but yet process the grief that I have over the loss of my daughter. She had been sick since birth. She had a disease called cystic fibrosis, and she battled that for 19 years, almost 20 years. She almost made it to her 20th birthday. I would almost consider that like my second bottom.
Sure.
In a lot of ways, I didn't relapse. However, I really felt like my world was crumbling around me. And the only thing that I could think of to do was to reach out to my counselor at Heartview. And she informed me of the fact that there was a grief support group for addicts at the treatment center. And I joined that, and that's been very helpful to be able to share my grief with other addicts.
Now, and the reason I wanted to bring that, of course, it's part of you, it's part of your life, but the obvious question from all of us who are in recovery is, how do you do that? And you've just partially answered that question, but as a person in recovery, how do you sustain that huge a loss? How do you retain your recovery, your abstinence through something like that? And you already answered that, but I'll bet you've been asked that question many times.
Yeah. The response that I usually give people is that it isn't me, that it's God. The first step, you know, admitting our powerlessness. And I do that every day. Because I do believe that it is a day-by-day process to stay in recovery and fight to stay in recovery. And I can't do that alone. My higher power definitely gets me through my days. Mm-hmm. If I had not turned all of this grief and everything that I'm going through right now over to my higher power, I wouldn't be here today. So really, it's a combination of finding a network of people who will support me, yourself, you know, reaching out to people who've been through a loss of a child. It brings comfort to people. And I don't think that's often understood by the general public that, you know, how to process grief and do it in a constructive way that you'll come out a better person, not a bitter person. Cause I don't want to be bitter.
Right.
No, I don't think that would be good for my recovery.
Right. Bitter or resentful.
Or resentful, yes. Yeah.
And you brought it up. And I lost a daughter, too. And I shouldn't say I. I mean, my wife and I and, you know, my entire family lost someone. But my wife and I lost a daughter 11 years ago. And she was 21 years old. And I was... Thank God I was strong enough in my recovery that I didn't have to drink or use over that incident. I didn't have to drink or use that week and beyond. And I don't know how, other than I was used to living a new life. I was used to recovery and living differently and having support. And being surrounded by the right kind of people. And for sure, during that week of the funeral and everything else, those people held us up. Those people, including relatives, friends, you name it. But they buoyed us up. I kind of use that word.
Absolutely. I have felt tremendous support. I've seen how God has placed people in our lives to help us through this process. And it's really been amazing. I think oftentimes, even in recovery, we can feel isolated and alone. And feeling alone is definitely a dangerous place to be.
So we've been talking about recovery. What are some of the things you've learned about grief? Maybe how it relates to recovery, or not necessarily, but I think grief can be a great teacher. Or loss.
Yeah, the loss of my daughter has given me a new perspective on life. I found it very interesting that people in my life, friends, family, who hadn't talked to me about feeling concerned about my recovery, they all seemed pretty, like I was pretty stable in my recovery. But as the 2 weeks that led up to my daughter's death, she was in hospice in our home, and people came to me and they were concerned. And so I, in turn, reached out, like I said, to Heartview. I started going to meetings and trying to reach out to folks there. People have just been amazing.
Mm-hmm. And now in turn, I think you can be helpful to others.
Yeah. And what I've learned through the loss of my daughter is that most people don't know how to be around people who are experiencing grief. They feel uncomfortable. They feel awkward. And I'll admit I was in that group of folks as well. However, going through a loss like this and being in recovery, it just reinforces the fact that you have to have a network of people around you. You can't do it alone. And I think that people can learn a lot of lessons from folks who are going through grief. The fact that just the sheer sitting and being present with someone can be healing. Mm-hmm. That's probably the first lesson I learned in the loss of my daughter, was just having people present with you is comforting.
Yeah. You know, and as a person, going to a funeral or going to the church, service or going to the wake, you don't even have to say anything, to just be there to support your friend, or your relative is enough. I think, and I'm afraid that sometimes people, they feel held back. You know, there's a little bit of fear and anxiety. They might stay away from the wake. They might stay away from the funeral service because they don't know what to do or say. Well, you don't have to do or say anything really, but to just be there. And I've certainly walked into the funeral home, knowing that, and just walking up to my friend who lost a son or a daughter or a spouse, and I just walk up to them and put my arms around them, and you don't have to say anything.
I think it's dangerous to say anything in that moment. I've been wounded and hurt by so many people who, with good intention, say things like, "Well, at least this. Well, at least your daughter's in heaven, or at least she's not suffering anymore. At least she's not on oxygen and she's not taking handfuls of pills anymore." And that's so hurtful when people say things like any statement that starts with "at least," it should be just eradicated from people's vocabulary. And I think people just need to just be present.
Right.
Don't say anything.
You know, and as you know, I'm a certified grief counselor. I recently read an article written by a woman who lost a baby and an infant, and she the whole purpose of the article was the stupid things that people say and what not to say and what to say. But for example, similar to what you said, a lot of people said, "Well, you're still young, you can have more," you know, which does nothing today to acknowledge her grief and her loss and her pain.
Right.
And that was the whole point of why she wrote this article. So useful. The one thing that we, and I know you heard this, the one statement that often annoyed us was, it was God's will. And I don't think that's true. I think in my opinion of God, He wants us to live. He wants us to be happy. And He doesn't move us around like little chess pieces and says, "This one will die of cancer today," or "This one will die in a car crash today." And so that was one of the statements that we objected to. Plus, the other one was, I guess God needed another angel. I was polite, but I wanted to say, "No, he didn't." You know, how do you know what God wanted? Or she's in a better place. So,
losing my daughter impacted me in a lot of ways that I would have never imagined. But before my daughter passed away, it was little less than 2 weeks actually before she passed. I had returned home from a road trip and found her to be in hospice in our home. And one of the first things she did was she gave me a coin, and this would have been the day after my 2-year sobriety date, so this would have been 9/12. She handed me a coin that she had purchased while she had spent a month in the hospital in Minneapolis. She gave me a coin signifying my 2 years of sobriety, and she hugged me and told me how proud she was of my sobriety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's the fuel that's going to keep me going forward, knowing that that your child is proud of your recovery.
Yeah.
It just does something for you.
Sure.
And I recently found a folder that was left over from my family day 2 years ago when I was in treatment. My daughter had written a lot of expectations down, and I had met all those, and I felt really good about that. Looking back 2 years, what she expected of me, I've accomplished and more. And just being able to look at those sheets of paper that she took the time to write these things down on, and at the end, she said that she was proud of me and she loved me.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And to find those items after a person passes away, it just, it helps.
Yeah. To find any item and to hear people talk about your daughter is also wonderful, isn't it?
I mean,
and that's another misconception that people have. They may not want to talk with you or to you about that loss or about her, because they think it'll cause too much pain, but it's kind of just the opposite, isn't it?
It's exactly the opposite. I found that I've been asked, well, what do you fear now that your daughter's gone? And I said, I fear that she's going to be forgotten. And when people don't text or they don't call or they don't stop by anymore a month or after the funeral, it hurts. But people don't want to, it's awkward. They don't want to hurt you by bringing it up. But like you said, it's the exact opposite. And I would encourage people, and I will going forward, to just reach out to people whenever you think of them. If you're praying for them, let them know, because that will, it doesn't hurt. It actually helps.
Mm. You know, and I'll admit, and I'm on Facebook, and that's one, and I try not to spend too much time on Facebook, but that's one of the things I like about Facebook. There are certain people who remember the date, that we lost our daughter, or her birthday, but in particular, the day we lost her, and they'll send us Facebook messages on that day, saying, I know what day this is, and so I just wanted to reach out to you and tell you that I'm thinking about you, and I love you. That really means so much.
It does.
And it's touching, you know. So how do you and how will you commemorate your daughter? You know, how will you continue to remember her? You know, honor her memory. And commemoration is a big word, but
sure.
Yeah.
At some point in the future, I plan to get a tattoo. Mm-hmm. I have no idea when
I have
will
one,
be.
By the way.
on 11/11, on Hannah's birthday, my wife, my 17-year-old daughter, and two of Hannah's friends went to the tattoo parlor, and we spent 5 hours there, and four people got tattoos. And what they did was, they mixed some of Hannah's ashes, since she was cremated, into the ink.
Wow.
And then they had it tattooed onto their body. And that was amazing for them to be able to honor Hannah that way.
Yeah. I hadn't heard that one. Wonderful.
Prior to that, we went to the Memorial Bridge and wrote notes to Hannah, tied them to flowers and threw them into the river.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Yeah. And on her birthday, you'll celebrate, and on the day you lost her, every year you'll remember her, think about her.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, back to recovery, and it's all related, but for someone who may be listening to us right now, and you've been, by God's grace, et cetera, successful in your recovery, and so for someone listening who they know they have a problem, they know they need to do something about it, what's your advice? How should they begin? You know, they've been procrastinating. They've been thinking about it. They know that they've got to change.
I really believe in finding somebody who has what you have and asking them how they did it. Mm-hmm. If somebody asked me how I did it, I would say that I went to a treatment center, got an evaluation. That was my first step. And I felt a lot of shame and probably some pride that I had to get over to be able to even walk into the treatment center. But if you can't wait till you get better to go into a treatment center, you have to go in while you're sick. Mm. And sometimes that's hard. And then, you know, start going to meetings. I've seen a lot of people go to meetings but not get a sponsor and work the steps. I tell people, I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. And I've passed it on.
Yeah.
And it's a tough question on how to encourage people to take that first step. I don't know if I have any magical answers other than to just do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's help out there. And if you seek it out, you'll find it.
And how about your relationship with your wife? How do you use that to help you and to help that relationship, especially through this raw period, you know, this time of loss?
I don't have anything specifically to say about that other than I know that it's God working in me. I admit my powerless every morning and throughout every day. And somehow God has healed our marriage. He's made it stronger. Oftentimes I think families split up when there's a loss of a child. Mm-hmm. And we are committed to not being that one of those statistics.
You talk about this loss often with your wife? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the things I didn't realize was that I needed her to be able to grieve properly. I can't do it on my own. When I'm with her, it brings me comfort. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that was going to be the case.
I too would have to say that, if anything, we've grown closer. And one of the things I learned by going to a grief support group early on was people grieve at different speeds. And if your spouse wants to talk about it today because she misses the loved one, you have to listen. You might not feel like going there, but it's really your job to be patient and to listen. And I'm glad I learned that. I've never said I can't talk about that right now, or especially. And here's another dumb thing people say sometimes: "Well, haven't you gotten over that yet?"
Yeah, you don't get over it. You go through it. That's a lesson I've learned. You can't go under it. You can't go around it. You have to go through it.
I like that. Yeah, and you know what? You don't want to get over it. You know, I don't want to forget.
Her, or
her memory, and
my daughter was a big inspiration to me to get sober, and she was proud of me in my recovery, and I want to honor that.
Yeah, and one of my favorite quotes is, "Grief is the price you pay for loving someone." So mm-hmm. We're out of time, and it went fast, and I knew it would. And we usually close Chadwick with the Serenity Prayer, and our guest has been Chadwick Kramer. God bless you, and let's close the program. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you so much.
Thank you.